townhall.com.
The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Welcome to The Lawyer's Edge, a program that seeks to answer your questions on civil, criminal, constitutional, and political legal matters with attorneys Robert J. Slama and David Trotty. Robert J. Slama is a U.S. veteran and prominent attorney who has served as counsel for some of Jacksonville's most high-profile cases. Robert Slama is a member of the Florida Bar and the U.S. Supreme Court Bar Associations. He's argued cases in Florida, as well as constitutional cases, before the highest court in the land. David Trotty is a Florida Bar attorney, practicing since 2000, and is a certified civil and family law mediator and a qualified arbitrator in the state of Florida. His practice focuses on family and criminal law issues and mediation. He's a former Marine who served in Japan and the U.S. Embassy in Austria and Tanzania. Also a federal police officer with the Central Intelligence Agency. It's now time to discuss today's legal topics and issues and how they impact your family and small business. Now, live from the WBOB studios, here's attorneys Robert J. Slama and David Trotty.
And welcome to another edition of The Lawyer's Edge. Hello, I'm Roger Henderson. Robert's on the way up. David Trotty here. I'm not a lawyer, but they are.
We are.
They practice law. And I only pretend to be a lawyer on TV sometimes, but I'm not actually an attorney. No, I'm not on TV. I'm being silly. But David, how you doing? How was the Memorial Day?
I'm doing wonderful. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
Not the best weather, but we made the most of it.
Yeah. Well, tropical storm. As hurricane season officially starts Friday. But we had a preview of what it will be like.
Well, Robert's in federal court at 1 o'clock. He should be getting here. Hopefully, he's on his way.
Yeah, I just got a text saying he is on his way from court on the way up. But you know, you and I are holding it down right now. One of the things that I have always been a little curious about are the different dynamics of the law. And one of the areas that you tend to spend a lot of time on is mediation.
That's right.
And I guess that's a type of practice in the law where people sometimes relinquish their right to go to trial and agree to arbitration. Is that something different?
You're saying it a little wrong.
Okay.
Okay, a lot wrong.
All right. Well, correct me. You're the attorney.
Well, you have pre-suit mediation.
Okay.
And you have, during the suit, you have mediation.
Okay.
You can voluntarily sign up for mediation or you can be court ordered to go to mediation.
Okay.
So the whole purpose of mediation is that you have more control of the outcome of your case. Okay?
All right.
So what happens is when you're in court, you have a judge sitting there. And the evidence and the testimony that you present to the judge is limited by the rules of evidence. So they can only hear certain things.
This is in an actual trial.
An actual trial.
Okay.
Trial or hearing. And so these judges are limited to what they can take as evidence and testimony, which is testimony is evidence, when they make a decision. So the courts are looking at your demeanor. They're looking at the you know, what you say, the evidence you produce, and kind of you know, earmarking the credibility of what you're producing to make their decision on right. where the gavel should lie.
Right.
And you don't know what you're going to get. You can go in there thinking that you have a case on all 4 points and you're going to win, and you come out on the losing end of the stick because a piece of evidence that you thought was going to be able to get in somehow there's objections to it, and it
right.
did not get in.
We've all seen the TV programs where someone wanted to say something who was on the witness stand, and then that was stricken from the actual evidence where it was not allowed. Typically, why does that happen in a trial?
Well, a lot of it's hearsay.
Okay.
Or protected communication, confidentialities.
I see.
That type of stuff. But when you get – so you're in the courtroom, there's okay. certain rules. Okay? Say you're in boxing, there's certain rules, certain things you can't do. Lack of a better word, mediation is kind of like a street fight.
Okay.
Okay, where it's not anything goes.
Uh-huh.
We have rules of mediation.
Okay.
We conduct ourselves.
But hearsay, for example, would be allowed in mediation or
well,
no?
We don't weigh the evidence.
I see.
But in the seat of a mediator, we also don't preclude people from telling us what's going on. What's the backstory of why you're asking what you're asking for?
Okay.
Which is riddled with hearsay, of course. You know, he said this, she said this. This is why I don't want to agree with this, because he said that yesterday, and my aunt said this Tuesday. It's riddled with hearsay. It's riddled with evidence that you'll never get into court.
Okay.
So what that, in the family law context, what that allows us to do is, while we're in mediation, we're going from room to room with the offers, everything in each room, we call them caucuses or individual breakout sessions, or a meeting with mom or a meeting with dad, whichever the case is.
Okay.
We hold that strictly confident in that room. Some mediators, like myself, I do like to use a small talk. And we talk to our clients, or the mediation clients, and we say, is there anything you don't want me to discuss? So all this hearsay, all these whys and the why nots, your case law, your strategy, the evidence that you might have, is there anything you don't want me to share with the other side? Because in the family law context, it could be a very short day at mediation if all you're going to go over there with, I want majority time sharing, you're going to pick the kids up at the sheriff's substation, you're going to pay twice the amount of child support that anybody would even think that you have to pay, and I want alimony for life on a 3-year marriage. So the other room's going to get that. They're going to pack up their bags. They're going to say, we're here in good faith. We don't even have a counter offer for that. Have a good day.
So basically, if you're in mediation, you can just pack up your, I mean, you pick up your marbles and go home and say, these people aren't serious.
You can. We try to get them to stay, mediate in good faith. But if one side's going to throw offers that are, you know, 2 continents away, mm-hmm. either we have to draw some bright lines and say, okay, what's the purpose here? Are we really just trying to get to trial?
Uh-huh.
Or is there something deeper?
Right.
Sometimes when we get those left field offers, there's something deeper. And that's where we talk about, when we're in caucuses with this side or that side, why are they offering that? There has to be something that this side doesn't know about. Okay?
Right.
So, you know, in family law, we have discovery, and most of your stuff is discoverable anyway. So if you're going to produce evidence at court, you have to disclose that prior to the hearing, so it's not trial by ambush.
Right.
Okay? So we talked to those sides, and we learned, with lack of rules of evidence in mediation, we listened to the hearsay, the backstory of why are you wanting him to pay twice as much child support? Or why do you want him to pay alimony for life, permanent alimony, when this is only a short-term marriage? So the backstory would be maybe something like this. During the marriage, I was in a car accident and I broke my back. I can no longer work. My job was a secretary. I have to walk assisted now.
Mm.
And there's certain things that they can't do, so their whole life was changed during the course of the marriage. So those, that backstory,
right,
when we go into the other room, the one who has to do a counteroffer, is we bring up that backstory. And then we can start controlling where mediation is and where we have a settlement or not.
Have you ever been in a situation where a client knew that everything was stacked, you know, in their favor, and they were digging in their heels, and there may have been some type of emotional investment as well, where they were really angry with the person that they were, on the other side of the case against, and at the same time decided that when the person came back with their counteroffer, it was lower than what they wanted. They insisted that you actually raise it at that point from your initial offer, because that's typically not how it's done. Am I correct? Usually, you know, you ask for X, and then they'll offer a little less than X, and you try to meet somewhere in the middle, but they've actually been so angry they wanted you to go higher than that as a punitive, knowing that if it went to trial, they would end up having it go in their favor anyway. No?
Yes and no. You're not wrong.
Okay.
But every mediation is different, okay? Every mediation, you don't have to agree. It's self-determination. You show up to mediation.
Mm-hmm.
You're there. And only time that there's an agreement is when everybody signs.
Okay.
Okay, so up till then, if there's 10 items on the board to discuss,
mm-hmm.
and you're not happy with, you know, number 3, but you're okay with the other ones, either you acquiesce and you move, or you might shuffle up number 7
right,
to get 3 back down where it needs to go.
So you've actually had a situation where you may have requested $1 million, they counteroffered $750,000, and your client was so unhappy with that, they upped it to $2 million at that point.
Sometimes. Okay, a lot of times.
Really?
And that's just how it goes.
Okay.
You know, so I'm asking for alimony of $2,000 a month.
Uh-huh.
And the other party is at No alimony.
Okay.
So we're like, because they think $2,000 is just ridiculous because the only disposable income the husband might have is $500. So we just got to get traction in the case. And when you get traction, you have self-determination and self-control.
All right. Avoiding going to court.
Let's do it.
With David Trotty. You're listening to The Lawyer's Edge. David Trotty and Robert Slummer. Robert will be here any moment. If you've got a question, feel free to call in at 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255. We'll be back with more of The Lawyer's Edge here on WBOB AM 600 and 101.1 FM.
A law firm dedicated to helping families. A law firm dedicated to you. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
Hi, I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. For over 17 years, I've assisted the Jacksonville community by providing a full-service law firm for families, not the rich and powerful, but for everyday families like yours. Since 1998, I have handled some of the most complicated cases in Jacksonville, including Brenton Butler, and more recently, the jury verdict in Jermaine DeBose. Whether it's family law, including divorce, custody, or bankruptcy, juvenile law, personal injury, probate, civil rights, or not-for-profit and churches, I'm dedicated to helping your family with your legal needs. I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. Call me anytime. My number is 904-296-1050, or you may text me at 838-8607. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
Welcome back to The Lawyer's Edge. I'm Roger, along with David Trotty, Robert Slama on his way in every Tuesday from 2 o'clock until 3. They are here to answer your legal questions, whatever they may be. And David tends to spend a lot of time focusing on an area of the law called mediation. And this is to try to handle the situation, I would imagine, contractually without actually having to go to court. When you negotiate with the person that you would be otherwise suing to kind of keep it out of the realm of the court, I guess reduce the court fees and that kind of thing. And you're sharing with us some insights, and that is to even reduce the likelihood of very important things that you consider important to the case from being excluded, right?
Well, you know, mainly I do family law. I'm also a civil circuit mediator. Mm-hmm. But staying in the family law arena is, especially when you have children. When you have children involved in a litigation case and you're going to go to court, the only thing that's going to happen after mediation is a further breakdown of the communication between the parties. And the only effect...
Does it get more expensive also?
Of course it does.
Okay.
You know, these lawyers aren't cheap out there. I know Robert, you know, he has his practice. He has a reduced rate. I'm just kidding, Robert, if you're listening. But most attorneys, it costs a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if it's one hearing or the final hearing. It's a lot of money. But if you get to mediation early on, if you can get your discovery done, get your attorneys to get your discovery to your attorney so they can get it to the opposing counsel, get it done, schedule mediation quickly, you should be able to resolve it and save some of the disparagement that's going to happen in court between the parties and the breakdown in communication.
Yeah.
So if you're able to do that, if we step back into mediation, the goal of mediation is to avoid court. Some people go into mediation with the attitude, I don't care what offer comes across, I'm going to court. And we have those that come across, probably I would say 1 in 20 mediations that we do. So when we're in the mediation huddle, our goal there is to prioritize what somebody is asking for.
Mm-hmm.
So some people, money's the priority. Now, hear this. People will say the kids are the priority, but really it's the money.
Mm-hmm.
People will say the kids are the priority on the other side, but really it's the money.
You see a lot of that in the Hollywood, you know, stories of, you know, the one of the spouses, one of the kids have custody of the one who has all the money so they can get child support and, of course, augment their standard of living when that's probably really what they want to do more than anything else, right?
You would hope not, but right. Probably so.
Right.
Now,
what about a situation where the primary custodial parent just wants to keep the kids in the same home they've always grown up in? Is that something that's also taken into consideration?
Well, we don't call it primary anymore, but the parent who has maintained the daily activities of the children, mm-hmm. more so than the other parent, mm-hmm. that is always what they're asking for is, let me have the children, let me keep them in the marital home or in another home, let me keep in control control.
Do you find that it adds a little bit more stability for the kids when, you know, mom and dad can't stay together, that they do stay in the home they've always lived in, or does that make a difference?
It depends.
Okay.
It depends. I mean, you have to look at every situation is different. There's not one mediation. I've done well over 2,000 mediations. There's not one mediation that's the same.
Mm.
When you're talking about kids and you're talking about time sharing, you have to look at all different types of factors. It's just not the work schedule. You know, it's just not the money. It's just not where you live. It's just not the schools that they go to. It's not just the domestic violence past or the criminal history or the mental health issues. You have to look at it all. And then the personalities of the parties in mediation. So we're doing all of this on a quick pace in mediation.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to figure out what is making the mom or the dad tick, or whichever spouse tick. So if it's a child-related mediation where time-sharing is the focus, we have to quickly figure out, is it about the money? Because if we can figure out if it's about the money, we can work some magic.
Okay.
If people will admit that all they're trying to do is get time-sharing to reduce child support, or they're trying to maintain a certain economic level in their house so they can support their kids, once we can scratch the surface and get that answered, we've got some room to wiggle.
Have you ever seen situations where one of the parties in the divorce is just being completely unreasonable and they're
Never.
Willing to?
That's a joke, right?
Never.
Robert, I remember a major television news personality who was on one of these morning breakfast shows that was all over the country, ended up losing his job. He was making like $1 million something a year during the weather. And unfortunately, things didn't work out between he and his wife. And she ended up getting a huge divorce settlement. He gets another job because the network TV show didn't work out. And he was making well into six figures, but still wasn't even near where he used to be, considering the fact that he had to give pretty much everything to her based on his former income. And I think he was left with somewhere around $35,000 a year, living in an area where that's poverty in some parts of the country. And I don't think she was willing to buck, and the judge wouldn't even listen to any kind of reduction in alimony at all.
Again, you have to look at the circumstances. Every case is different.
He was having to fly to Vegas every other week to try to make money just to pay his rent.
What do you think about that, Robert?
You know, it sounds like I was going to give you the joke, because this is reality. Most people, well, here's what they want. They want what I call a good divorce. Now, as I say that...
There's no such thing, I would imagine.
No. Trust me. Uh-huh. Everyone's thinking this. But let me give you the definition of a good divorce. It means I'm reasonable. I want them to agree to what I want. I don't want to pay any attorney's fees, and I want this done quickly. Can you do that? And I always start out and say, sure, we can do that. Where do you think we're going to do that? In other words, what happens is what people are motivated by is a belief, which is this. I'm reasonable, so you should agree. And this shouldn't cost much because I'm a reasonable guy.
Right.
Here's the problem. For a case to settle, two people have to get to the finish line at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What's unfortunate, and David has seen these, I've litigated cases where I always use what I call the Trumpian approach because it's the only approach. Some people go, let's just negotiate. That doesn't work. Negotiate and fight simultaneously, and what happens is, people don't come around until they see that their king is almost ready to get eaten, right, on the board. So when you just negotiate, what you end up doing is you talk.
For hours
until someone gets very, very tired.
And in family law, lawyers are paid by the hour, so it's actually costing you more
money
anyway.
But people are trying to avoid the inevitable. In other words, you can't always go around the storm. And when you know what's right is, when someone comes in and says, the two of us have talked. We've agreed on all these issues. We just need it typed up, essentially. And that's not even the end, because there's still work to be done. They don't know all the issues. They know the issues they agree on, but they don't know all the issues in the case that they're going to have to resolve. So in those cases, you know they're close enough. You just hope whatever the new thing is, it isn't something that's going to blow the whole thing up.
Right.
But right?
I agree. Now, you were mentioning earlier about, do you have the basically the windfall of a case? Now, what Robert was saying is you negotiate and you litigate at the same time. You can go into these mediations and you can talk for a long time, but at some point, someone has to learn the vulnerability of their case. Once you learn the vulnerability of your case or your opponent's case and it's out there, then you have some stake in it and you can negotiate. with fruitful offers going back and forth. But if somebody thinks that they're invincible in court and the court's never going to make me pay child support, they're never going to make me pay alimony, and the other side or the attorney for that person that might be paying alimony or child support is saying, don't worry about it.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, child support's actually required by the state. Alimony is not. Am I correct or no?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, because child support belongs to the child. You can't technically waive it, but alimony is personal to you.
Okay.
So there's not an alimony schedule like there's a child support schedule.
Okay.
Okay, a worksheet. You know, we do all these statutory configurations for child support. There isn't that for the alimony. Okay, so you fit the criteria that you might be awarded alimony. So if you fit the criteria to raise a claim for alimony, then you go through all the nuances and the facts and everything else. But there's so many times when there is a belief that there is an alimony claim, and it's not until we get to mediation, because maybe they haven't done depositions yet. Maybe they haven't done deep disclosures. They've done the surface disclosure, what we call mandatory disclosures, but they haven't gone real deep. But we get to mediation, and we're looking at it. Again, like I said earlier, this person's wanting $2,000 in alimony because during the marriage, they lived off of this amount of money. But when you get to mediation and we're realizing there's going to be house A and house B, mm-hmm. electric A, electric B, internet A, internet B, food A, food B, you have to divide the money. And it's not just we each get half. Lots of times there's a need for alimony, but there's not an ability to pay.
Okay.
Now, whether that ability to pay is manufactured or not, and that's maybe what your celebrity friend was facing, is the court didn't believe that his lowered income was involuntary or permanent.
Right. Okay. Permanent, probably not involuntary, not permanent.
That's the biggest thing is it has to be substantial. And I see this applied wrong so many times. I got a new job, or I lost my job, and I want to file for a reduction of alimony.
Or possibly the judge could be so angry with the person's behavior. Maybe there was domestic violence, and they want to, you know, execute some punitive type of alimony payment on that, or does that happen?
I don't think we do that in court.
Okay. All right.
Not supposed to.
All right.
So, yeah, you can't. We had a case where the judge, there was a bad domestic violence in front of a child. Mom's arm was broken. Mom was hospitalized. Hmm. We went in there. All we asked for is marital share of the 401k. I'm not sure. It was over $100,000. Just get marital share. And the judge awarded 100% of it to the mother without justification of the other half is because of this lump sum alimony or maybe equitable distribution scheme or something. No warrantable deviation for that. And basically what it was is because she was the victim of domestic violence and had to go to the hospital, he did a punitive action and basically gave her 100% of the 401k. That was quickly reversed by the DCA.
I was going to say, was that appealed?
Yeah. Appropriately so.
Okay.
Now, if she had filed a count two for damages for that tort that happened, and she made a claim and there was damages that she could measurable damages, the court could probably do that. But that's not what was before the court.
Okay. All right. Probably not a lot of time to get into it before we get the break for news, but I'd like to talk about the situations where there has to be supervised custody, where one of the spouses or parents is not considered to be stable enough to be in the presence of his or her own kids without somebody else there. Who is that other person? Is it someone who's hired by the state? Is it the other parent? They have to do like a family outing again. And I also would like to talk about well, go ahead.
Well, there's a lot of different ways you can handle that. So supervised time sharing doesn't have to be just for a mental instability of of a parent seeing the kids. It could be for other issues too. It could be for long absences. So a military guy was overseas for 2 or 3 years.
I see.
Know the child.
So the child doesn't know their mom and dad anymore.
Something like that. Okay. It could be the child has some issues and there's a safety concern.
Okay.
It could be that the dad or mom just doesn't have a place to stay and they can't figure out a third party to help them out.
All right. Okay. And also, I'm thinking all this, I hate to say it because you never want a marriage to end a divorce, but prenuptial agreements could probably eliminate a lot of this, huh? But we do need to take a break.
They create their own share of litigation, too. But call us at 222-TALK.
904-222-8255 here on the Lori's Edge. AM 600, 101.1 WBOB.
AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Bob Agnew in Washington. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly has agreed to stay on the job through the 2020 elections. There has been speculation he may have been in disfavor with the president, but Kelly says that the president asked him to stay on through 2020 and that he has agreed to do so. Prosecutors have lined up 35 witnesses and more than 500 pieces of evidence now in the federal trial of Donald Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. He's accused of tax evasion and bank fraud. This trial will center on Manafort's Ukrainian consulting work and only briefly touch on his involvement with the president's campaign. U.S. home prices rose rapidly in May. It's a trend that's thwarting some would-be buyers and pulling down home sales figures overall. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller 20-City Home Price Index rose by 6.5% in the month of May. On Wall Street right now, the Dow is up 148 points. The NASDAQ up by close to 60. This is SRN News.
Download WBOB's mobile app for free from your app store. Powered by Duval County Judicial Candidate Kimberly Sadler.
When our health insurance renewal notice arrived last fall, my wife and I made the decision to drop our plan. With the monthly premiums and deductible, we'd have to pay $30,000 just to use it. So we did our homework and switched to MediShare. The cost savings are incredible, over $500 a month, and we don't have to pay for services we don't need or don't agree with. Then, out of the blue, she had to have emergency surgery. Scary stuff. $150,000 in hospital bills, and MediShare members took care of everything. All we paid was our small portion. I'm a doctor who's been in healthcare for 20 years, and this is one of the most impressive programs I've ever seen. Thank God she's fully recovered, and now we're telling everyone about MediShare.
Call 877-64-BIBLE to find out how much you can save on your healthcare. MediShare. Call 877-64-BIBLE. That's 877-64-BIBLE.
This is Bill Martin with God First Ministries. Jesus opened a new way, a way to the Father. In John 14, verse 6, Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Ephesians 2, verse 18 says that through Jesus, we have access to the Father. Jesus opened the way to the Father, starting here and now in this life. You have a good Father, our awesome God. He has good plans for you and wants good for you in every part of your life. Right now, you have direct access to the Father through Jesus. Spend some quality time with your Father God.
This message has been brought to you by God First Ministries of Jacksonville. For more information, visit their website at godfirstmin.com.
Dr. Gene A. Youngblood, pastor of First Conservative Baptist Church, invites you to worship with them. 9:30 a.m. Sunday for Bible study. 10:45 a.m. Sunday, expository preaching of God's Word. 7 p.m. Sunday, expository preaching of God's Word. 7 p.m. Wednesday, Bible Q&A with fellowship meal. They're located at 12021 Old St. Augustine Road in the heart of Mandarin, just 1 mile south of I-295.
Hi, everybody. It's your morning show host, Ed Dean, right here on Talk Radio WBOB. The primaries are right around the corner here. Now we're going to the months as currently into July and August. Republican-Democrat debates. We cover it all every day right here on the morning show. We always take your calls at 222-TALK, 222-8255, 6 to 9, Monday through Friday, the morning show. Ed Dean, Roger Henderson on FM 101.1, AM 600, Talk Radio WBOB.
Lawyers Edge is on the air. I'm Roger Henderson, along with Robert J. Slama and David Trotty, who are practicing law, attorneys at law, and we've been talking a little bit about mediation and kind of explaining how that all works. And this is, for those just tuning in, mediation is, I guess, the pre-trial opportunity to avoid having to go to court. Is that probably the best way to describe it for the layperson?
Sure.
Okay.
It's an opportunity to work it out yourselves. But the problem is, and this is what we were talking about on another show, mediation, a lot of people think mediation is the golden bullet. So you'll hear them say, I just need to get to mediation. Why? Because if I get to mediation, everything's done. Like, no. That's why I'm going to go back to you and say this. Fight, negotiate, fight, negotiate. In other words, the way Nixon said it, which is true, don't expect to get at the negotiating table that which you were unable or unwilling to do on the battlefield. Why do people come to an agreement? Well, one is risk assessment. You come to the understanding that it's in your best interest to do so. Everyone doesn't see risk the same way. So in other words, if your attorney is convinced, Roger, that you're going to win no matter what happens, why is your client going to want to give in? Well, a lot of attorneys don't understand risk assessment, or they don't understand what the reality is of their own case. Why don't they? Well, the way the case is postured procedurally, they may have that belief because you have the other side hasn't done anything to show them that they're at risk. So you go through this. By the way, this isn't just family. I go through this in civil cases. For example, I had a case not too long ago, 4 years ago. He offered us $500, the filing fee.
That's it?
From general counsel. Then they offered us $1,500. We went to trial, got $372,500. The court, since retired, he thought we got $35,000. Okay, you say, how can people misread it? I spent a lot of time in halls. I always tell people, my track record, I'm off plus or minus 0.05 in valuing something. I'm usually pretty darn close.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion, a lot of people, they try to look at it as one size fits all. So they kind of combine and lump stuff together and go, well, this is about what it should be. You got to play the facts. So when I'm grading my cases, I go, do I have A facts, B facts, C facts, D facts? If I have a D facts case, why would I be expecting to get A facts payment? But when I have A facts for my case, why would I take D facts payment? Mm-hmm. You see? So you got to be able to judge and evaluate, understand what your witnesses are, and what you really think is going to happen at trial, of course. Nothing's perfect, but the better understanding you have of the litigation, you have an understanding of what moves they're going to make, what moves you're going to make, and how this is going to be received. You know, like poker, you may have a C hand, but you might be able to get an A result.
Right.
But some people are just out there, they're just bluffing. They don't know what they're doing. So when I go in and I do my valuation from the beginning, I have a strategy. In other words, and it goes like this. When we get to mediation, when they cross this line, it's a serious offer. Until they cross that line, not interested. So, I mean, you have to be able to understand and prepare and drive your client to the right finish line, because ultimately, if they're taking your advice, both good and bad, if you miss an opportunity in mediation, then you go to trial and get your head handed to you,
mm-hmm.
What have you done? Not much.
Right.
And the other way around, don't think for a second. People don't agree to something in mediation, quote, to be done. 2 weeks later, 2 days later, they look at it and go, why'd I do that? That's a bad deal.
Right, right. I've got a friend, guys, who apparently there was like some interest. Anyway, wealthy family and, you know, all things equal, middle class, young lady. And they you know, were talking about maybe getting married into this wealthy family. And the family of the groom-to-be wanted to have a prenuptial agreement. But you just mentioned before the break that those aren't necessarily as ironclad as people think they would be, right?
Well, you got to remember, let's take the Trump. And I use Trump just because now we negotiate. Most good attorneys are negotiating most days over something. Sometimes it's millions, sometimes it's $50. And when I say the Trump approach, I'm just saying an approach where you're not easy to pick up on what you're actually after. But in the end, he's always setting something up. So for example, you realize someone may file suit on a prenup just to bring you to the table because you wouldn't agree otherwise. So in other words, sounds a little Trumpian, right? What I'm going to do is...
It just kills the romance, though, in the early part of the marriage. How common is that, people doing prenups?
You want to hear something funny?
Yeah.
More women today.
Women?
I have coming in. I used to have older white doctors and older businessmen. Now I have 30s women, mid-30s, say. They've worked. They have a house. They have a 401k. They come in and go, if this doesn't work, he ain't getting any of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, without the prenup, would he be able to make a claim, anything that was premarital assets?
Depends.
Exactly. You have, and as Dave explained, there's separate property.
Okay.
And that pre-exists the marriage. The definition of marital property are things acquired during the marriage with marital funds. So if it pre-existed the marriage, it can't be marital. However,
right, but if there's a house and a mortgage is being paid on it, then technically it's anything you made after that. Any, I guess,
we move into
equity building that would.
But it gets more complicated than that because you move into now her separate house, right? You make an improvement, you add on to it. What about passive appreciation? You get into a lot of other issues. Because I built a sunroom in the back, now I've increased the value of the house $40,000 to $50,000. What about that? This is a doctrine that very few attorneys know and use. And so this is where I'm getting into. This is just one issue when it comes to this issue. It's called interspousal gifting. Interspousal gifting. Let's say I had separate property, and this just came up at our conference, a case. Interspousal gifting. I have a whole lot of money. I own a farm out in McClenny, let's say. 50 acres. I got horses. I got everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's my property. I'm allowing you to use it, go out there, stay out there, bring your family, do stuff. I give you the key. Say, go there whenever you want. Did I just gift it to you?
I don't think so. But you would probably have a different answer.
Well, no, I mean, you got to remember, though, this is why I'm saying all mm-hmm. this stuff matters. Once I have a viable claim against it,
mm-hmm.
now you got to talk to me to pay me off to get rid of thee. You follow?
Right.
It starts the basis for negotiating. So now I'm sending them a letter saying, I think we got some interspousal gifting going on here. They dig in and say, no, we're never going to pay you. We're never going to pay you. Well, then you're going to have to litigate. That guy litigated, and guess what? He lost.
Right. Now, I've also heard that, you know, people who have the means, very wealthy people who have, you know, housekeeping staff living in your home, that could create a whole series of problems if the job doesn't work out, because you'd have to evict them at that point. Am I right?
Oh, well, anytime you have someone staying there for an extended period of time, right. I always recommend that you have an agreement with them. This has happened to me in family. In fact, David represented the wife prior to getting out of the case.
Right. You look at the Brady Bunch growing up like you and I did, you know, you think, oh, Alice, you know, but suppose Alice, you know, she just, the place wasn't really, you know, working out. She wasn't as neat as you wanted to get a new live-in maid. You can't just let Alice go. You have to go through a 90-day process.
unless you have an agreement, and my agreements say you're waiving any requirement for eviction. Once we give you notice, you have 3 days to vacate.
Mm.
Otherwise, you're a trespasser.
Okay.
But, I mean, you got to have the terms set before that person comes into the house.
What if it's someone who isn't necessarily, you know, a very wealthy person with a live-in maid or housekeeping or butler, but they just have a relative or a friend staying with them for a little bit, maybe over the summer? Do you recommend having something in writing also similar to that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Anytime, I mean, no, I'm not saying.
Look at David's like, yep.
Look, anything, you know, the only thing in life is, Roger, things can change. And then the point is, do you want that person there for 90 days fighting an eviction and all this other stuff going on?
Yeah. You wouldn't have think that would be necessary, though. You know, you have someone, you know, stay with you, you know, their cousin Joe or whatever, staying for the summer. And next thing you know, Joe doesn't want to leave and you can't kick him out.
Well, you can.
You can, but then you're creating all kind of legal liability for yourself, right?
Criminal. We have a doctrine, mala tremendis. They're a
wow.
trespasser. You can gently lay hands on them and escort them off the property. You know how that goes today,
right?
What was gentle turns into physical, which turns into people pulling guns.
Now, would you be able to call the police saying this person's trespassing and it's a friend and that kind of thing?
And the police would say,
sorry, this is a civil matter, right?
They're going to come up and say, who are you? I'm Uncle Joe. Joe, how long you been here? I've been here for a month. This guy's crazy. Roger Henderson, all of a sudden, he got up mad today. He got into a fight with his wife, and now he says, get out. They're going to say to you, and they should, this is a civil matter. Take this up in court.
And the guy can't even be forced to leave.
Yes, sir.
Wow. You're listening to The Lawyer's Edge. If you have a question or comment, feel free. 904-222-TALK, 904-222-8255. We'll be back with more of Robert Slama and David Trotty here on WBOB AM 600 and 101.1 FM.
A law firm dedicated to helping families. A law firm dedicated to you. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
Hi, I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. For over 17 years, I've assisted the Jacksonville community by providing a full-service law firm for families, not the rich and powerful, but for everyday families like yours. Since 1998, I have handled some of the most complicated cases in Jacksonville, including Brenton Butler, and more recently, the jury verdict in Jermaine DeBose. Whether it's family law, including divorce, custody, or bankruptcy, juvenile law, personal injury, probate, civil rights, or not-for-profit and churches, I'm dedicated to helping your family with your legal needs. I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. Call me anytime. My number is 904-296-1050, or you may text me at 838-8607. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
Final segment of this edition of The Lawyer's Edge with Robert Slama and David Trotty. And feel free to call if you've got any legal question at all. We've been talking about mediation. We've been talking about, you know, that friend or relative who you let stay on the couch for a couple of months now has a legal right to stay in your house unless you bring about a legal action that could take, you know, several months to get them out. And they have a legal right to stay there. But you can charge them rent at that point or no?
Well, I mean, that's a whole... I mean, you hope that that kind of a situation doesn't present itself, but here's something that's more likely. Okay. Getting into some stuff that might be more common. How often have you seen it after someone, say, in a state of separation, there's a court order. The court order says she's got exclusive use of the home, you don't. Then they start getting back kind of quasi together, at least for overnights where there may be some... romantic activity going on, other things, and then it leads from that to
negotiations.
Yes, that's one word for it.
I don't know anything about any of this kind of stuff. I'm just listening.
Romantic negotiations, which end up in this: why don't you just stay here for a while? So now he moves back in, puts his stuff in. She has exclusive use of the home. They get going. What, about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks?
And there's a fight.
And then there's a fight, and then she says,
"Get out,
get out." And he says, "No." She says, "But look at the papers. I have exclusive use and possession of the home." Officer, now these are the ones that put officers in interesting situations. He shows up at the door. She shows her little papers and says, "She has a superior right to the home."
Mm-hmm.
But I've been here for 3 weeks. Really,
I've reestablished my stake in the house.
My residency. I'm back. She had it. But she gave, what's what we call tenancy, right?
Okay.
Tenancy law.
What if they didn't have their mail transferred, or does that make a difference at all?
Some don't, okay. Just because everything's in limbo. They're not sure, so she'll get all the mail and then give it to him during exchange with the kids, something like that.
Okay.
But so that's not always the thing. But I mean, when you ask how these situations happen, because real life happens, people don't make their decisions because of a piece of paper from a court necessarily. You're doing things in real time. All he knows is, I was over there. She liked me. She invited me to stay.
And I'm staying.
And I'm staying. And I'm here and I'm happy. Now she says, get out. Yeah. Because the reason I'm saying is, this case, I had that happen.
This actually happens.
I actually had it happen. And no, I'll give you a better one. She then called the police. He got arrested for domestic violence. And then when he got out of jail.
Then you have to leave, right?
Well, he had to. But,
okay.
But there was a no contact order. But he, as to her, but he had exclusive use and possession of the home in the divorce 3 years earlier.
So now she has to leave.
And I gave paperwork I had to give to a neighbor to have drop off and say, you don't belong here. You have to go. Her answer was, go where? I'm quite happy here.
Hmm.
Now, then from there, we did get the police involved, and I got the police officer to come out and check on her, the papers. And then the following day she left. But if she didn't leave, I had my agreement with her. So that way I would have gone into court, shown the agreement, he has exclusive use and possession. and see about getting her out. In that case, here's the funny part about the whole thing. Why did he let her in? She was sick. He didn't want her driving because she was taking very heavy medications. And what does she end up doing? She comes into the house, and then when she got into the house, she didn't want to leave. And in the end, she got him kicked out and was trying to stay in the house with the kids. I have seen about everything you can imagine that goes on between, you know, two folks under these circumstances.
And another very common one is you have that scenario. One party gets exclusive use of possession and ownership of the house, but the other party never moves out. And I have evicted several spouses because once you have that final judgment, they're supposed to move out. Because usually it's the wife shall vacate the marital home or the husband shall vacate the marital home on such and such date in the future. Gives them 30, 60, 90 days to get their act together, find a place, down payments, all that kind of stuff. Well, that day comes and goes. And so now you're in this contract, which she's breached. So she had the right to be there for 30, 60, 90 days.
Right.
Now she's not there. So now you need to go file an eviction and actually evict her.
Real life circumstances, huh?
Oh, but then keep in mind when you have children, you have the children, this is how this goes.
Oh, gosh.
What's daddy or mommy doing here? Well, they're here. They're going to be here because mommy's going through medical stuff and I don't want her driving. So she's going to be here for 2-3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Now she starts taking over dinner, starts taking over the room.
Movie time.
The whole, I want to go outside. What do you mean you're going outside? We were just watching TV together. I mean, all this stuff starts. At the end of it, then someone's getting kicked out. Now, from the kid's standpoint, hey, it was great seeing so-and-so show up. Now they're here.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of hoping things are getting better. Things deteriorate, and then how they end is someone getting kicked out. Does that sound good?
It ended up being worse. It's a bad yo-yo for the kids.
I know.
Very bad.
Gosh, Shane and I are saying this on the air, but it's a true story. Neighborhood I used to live in, apparently there was a similar situation to what you're describing. The new boyfriend moves in. So you got husband, new boyfriend, or ex-husband, new boyfriend, and wife, all living under the same roof with the kids. That's, you know, I guess it happens, I guess, in some cases. It happened in this case.
Daddy's home, too. It's kind of, you know, let's go on vacation together. Let's do this as one.
If anything, this really, I believe, sets up a very good argument for the purposes of premarital counseling. And to talk about how to do things right and to make sure you have as least a little dysfunction in your marriage as possible and hopefully one that lasts for the long haul.
I don't think there's any amount of counseling that would ever prepare somebody for divorce or what could happen in divorce because, remember, they have rose-colored glasses on.
Right.
When they're in this this honeymoon, they're about to get married, and she could do no wrong, he could do no wrong. You know, he's Prince Charming, you know, she's the princess. And no one can get through these guys' thick heads of the repercussions of getting married and what's going to happen. Marriage is a beautiful thing. I love the sacrament of marriage. It's beautiful. However, there's a fallout. You have to understand your maturity level and what you're capable and not capable of doing. You have to understand when you go into a marriage, if he gets sick, the whole death do you part is you might be liable for caring for him, even if you want a divorce.
Well, you made a commitment, you know, in sickness and in health.
Yeah. So we take that, yeah, you can to death do us part, to divorce, judge lays down the gavel.
Mm-hmm.
But that death do you part might be real in the form of alimony, child support, property distribution, and everything else.
Right.
So you really have to think about when you're saying I do or even going to ask the question, make sure you're both on the same sheet of music. And things are going to change during your relationship. You're going to grow. He might go to school. You might not go to school. You might go to school. He might drop out of school and just
he
work.
May gain weight. She may gain weight.
None of that ever happens.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand that stuff happens. You grow apart. One person gets educated. One person stays level. One person puts the other person through school. Well, the other person's working at Winn-Dixie or whatever.
Then you have the dynamic of kids and the pressures that creates in the family. Just the caring for them. Not you don't love your kids, but, you know, that adds a new dynamic to the relationship.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Huge. And then, you know, we're in a Navy town. So I think the people who – I really think the people who need the most counseling before they go get married are military personnel. They don't understand the implications of getting married at E1, E2, E3. E4, E5. When you're at those income levels, number one, it's low, but But then you live on this like false cloud of income because of BAH, BAQ, hazard pay, and everything else. And now we're raising kids. Hey, if we get more dependents, get more money, this whole fallacy that's out there. But you're going to be responsible for caring for these kids if you're out of the Navy or military service. And same with the wife. And we gotta make sure we're advising our armed service members on the repercussions of divorce or having a child out of wedlock. I don't think we're doing enough of it.
You know, David, we're talking about probably the number one issue that affects most people through a divorce is co-parenting. And the reason I'm saying these are flip sides of the coin. When people are getting together, you, your wife, anyone, what you see and what you get when you're single is completely different than if you have 2, 3, 4 kids, you're working, you're managing things, going through the Great Recession, all this stuff, healthcare changing, all these things change, you know, the respective issues between the parties, at least financially. The ability, what issues and challenges forces people to do is it puts stress on your ability to compromise, or what I call reconciliation skills. Those get put to the 10th power. Add to that, as the kids are changing and keeping up with them, if you have different parenting styles, different parenting goals, there's this one guy on TV, I love his whole approach to this whole thing. He calls it strength-based marriage. Focusing on the strengths that each of you have in the marriage versus what the opposite is. Well, Roger can do these three things good, but he doesn't do these four things well. What people tend to gravitate to is, and if you do this in a marriage, you're doomed. If you do this post dissolution, so while you're trying to co-parent, people are still using the same language. He doesn't do this. He doesn't do this. He doesn't do this. He doesn't do this.
Happens in the work environment, too. You know, sometimes they don't, you can overlook your strengths and what you bring to the table and all. They can focus on what you can't do very well.
Well, everyone has an area that they need to improve in. Mm-hmm. No one runs 100%. But my point is,
well, David does. But
when people are talking about their level of satisfaction or dissatisfaction or why I can't co-parent with her, you're still looking at what she may or may not do well and what you may or may not do well. Mm-hmm. But I say we're co-parenting, marriage, the whole thing. Begin with celebrating the strengths you have, building upon the strengths and what helping to take the weaknesses and turn them into strengths. We don't do that.
Yeah, but we think once that divorce paper is signed by the judge, all that's going to go away and we're going to be able to communicate.
Clean slate.
Clean slate. He can now parent. She can now parent. We can now communicate. And it's further from the truth.
In fact, in many instances, you're worse off.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't co-parent in the same house, you're going to have a hard time co-parenting outside of the same house.
Communication goes with you. That doesn't change overnight because you have a piece of paper. How you see the world, what your work schedule is. All now you're doing it with less money and farther apart.
This sounds very, well, wow. A lot to digest right now.
That's why.
Real quick, silver bullet on how people can avoid these problems? No.
There is a silver bullet, and it's pretty easy. I think forgiveness is number one.
Uh-huh.
And number two is